Welcome to Parents Perspective. Lenny, please sit down, his exasperated second grade teacher begged for the fifth time that morning. Lenny was just one of those kids who seemed to be distracted by the world. He had just jumped up from his desk, knocking over his reading workbook and his pencils in his exuberance. Look, Mrs. Palmer, he leaned over the windowsill and pressed his face to the glass. It's a monarch butterfly. Yes, Lenny, thank you for sharing that, but right now we are working in the reading workbook. Could you please return to your desk? I have a rock just like this at my house, Lenny exclaimed, picking up a sample from the science shelf below the window. Do you know why it sparkles? It's got little specks of mica in it, he offered. Mrs. Palmer sighed and walked over to take Lenny's hand and lead him back to his desk. From a parent's perspective, how can we help our children who have attention deficit disorder or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Our guest today can help us sort out the terminology and what it all means for us. Dr. Alan Zametkin has been a staff psychiatrist at the National Institute of Mental Health for 19 years. He studies ADHD and the use of prescription stimulant drugs for treatment. Dr. Zametkin is the father of two teenage daughters. Welcome to Parents Perspective, Dr. Zametkin.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
The terms ADD and ADHD are tossed around quite a bit these days in the news. What are these conditions?
Attention deficit hyperactivity disorder is a disorder first described at the turn of the century, and it is a neurological condition that affects children's ability to pay attention and control their behavior, which is divided into two forms, the hyperactive impulsive form or the purely inattentive form.
How can a parent recognize if his own child has this disorder?
This problem becomes apparent to parents through a variety of different sources. The most common scenario for children receiving this diagnosis or for parents to find out is actually through feedback from school. Predominantly, kids in kindergarten and most commonly in first, second, and third grade will start to develop symptoms in this educational setting, and parents will first become aware that there are problems from teachers. Teachers have the perspective of seeing large number of kids who have a whole host of either learning problems, no learning problems, normal behavior, or abnormal behavior. So the most common scenario is that parents will start to get feedback over an extended period of time from a variety of different sources that their youngster is not behaving or not able to perform in a fashion consistent with their age. So parents also notice on their own that the behavior of their youngsters is more difficult than their friends' children. For example, they will find that their children don't listen, their children can't stay on task, their children may be up and down during meals, their children may have very poor impulse control, and they will find that parenting these children can be very difficult or very frustrating. And I think what usually happens is that between getting feedback from teachers in the educational setting and their own experience, that parents come to the recognition that there's something that is not quite right about what's going on with their child.
These symptoms always show up then in that basic age group, the lower elementary group, you'd think?
I would say that about 9 times out of 10, children first become symptomatic. That is, that their behavior is not consistent with the expectations of school or their parents, predominantly by third, fourth, or fifth grade. There are rare exceptions where a middle schooler or a high school student will, for the first time, be diagnosed. But in general, this is a disorder that presents very early, is identified by the third or fourth grade. What's interesting about the third grade is that that's a time where children are expected to be able to work independently, and much more in the way of self-control is necessary to be a successful third grader. You know, first graders and kindergarten kids, by their very nature, developmentally have short attention spans, have a restlessness, et cetera, and it takes a very experienced, seasoned kindergarten or first or second grade teacher to be able to differentiate between what is so-called normal and abnormal. And unfortunately, we don't have any blood tests or biological markers, EEGs, psychometric testing to make this diagnosis. This is a diagnosis that is made by taking a history from the parents and getting input from educators about the different aspects of behavior.
So if My pediatrician recommends that I bring my little child in to see a child psychiatrist because of some of these symptoms. What would you do? Just ask questions of me, or would you observe the child?
Right. The evaluation for this disorder can be done by social workers, can be done by pediatricians, child psychiatrists, child psychologists. And the essential pieces, as far as I'm concerned, are taking a very careful history to rule out look-alike syndromes, because all children who have the symptoms, which again are inattention, impulsivity, poor self-control, some kids have the motor restlessness, which can be simply fidgetiness or inability to stay seated or sort of driven as if they're run by a motor. You know, the symptoms are there to be ascertained, but there are many other disorders that can look like ADHD that need to be considered in the evaluation. So the evaluation includes careful history taking from the parents. It includes reports from school, that is, whether the person who's doing the evaluation just personally calls the teacher and says, what are your observations? Or there are rating scales that teachers can fill out. But clearly you want input from other than the parents. And we do want to interview and see these children. Now, children's behavior, whether it's in the pediatrician's office, in a child psychiatrist's office, is very different than in a classroom. And the classroom is much more stimulating. It's much less structured than a one-on-one situation. So it is very common for a child with even severe ADHD to behave absolutely normally in an evaluation setting. That's because there's, you know, much more pressure. There may be increased anxiety in an evaluation. So what we directly observe in the 30 minutes or the hour that we spend with these kids is a very small piece of the overall evaluation. We clearly want to make sure the kids are not having other problems that can look like ADHD, such as depression, such as anxiety disorders, that is, kids who have many worries, fears, and are exceedingly anxious. Highly stressful households can make kids look like they have ADD, although you can have both ADD and a highly stressful household. And if you don't treat the ADD, it's difficult to help get some of the stress down. So just because there's a stressful household or, you know, some sort of a major problem going on in the home, it doesn't mean that you can't also have ADHD. So we want to look for learning disabilities, because a third of children who have attention problems will also have a classic learning disability as defined by 1 to 2 years behind grade level in reading, spelling, math. So that the disorder ADHD is very commonly what we say comorbid, that is, co-occurs with kids with learning disabilities. And all children with learning disabilities need to be screened for ADHD, since many, many children with a learning disability can have this syndrome of behaviors called ADD or ADHD.
Why are those two very often connected?
Well, when you think about it, if you have one neurological disorder, which a learning disability clearly is, it makes it much more likely that you're going to have a second one. It's a little like, you know, being elderly. You know, when you become over 60 or over 70 years old, besides having arthritis, you may have a little problem, you know, with gout or a little heart disease or high blood pressure, whatever. But when you have one neurological problem, it makes it very common that you'll have a second one. So we do see this huge overlap between learning disability and ADHD, which in my view are two separate but addressable problems.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion of attention deficit disorder and attention deficit hyperactivity disorder.
Two excellent books written by hosts Sandra Burt and Linda Perlis, Parents as Mentors and Washington, D.C. with Kids, are available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents' Perspective. Today we are talking with Dr. Alan Zemetkin about ADD and ADHD.
I remember years ago when I was teaching in high school, and this is a long time, probably prior to this kind of definition of this problem, having kids in the classroom who could not sit down, who sat on the windowsill, had to pace, you know, back and forth across the room. And if I didn't let them do that, then I would have a major discipline problem. But if I let them move around, they learned in the classroom.
Right. Well, that's one of the interesting things about these kids, is it's very important to accommodate their needs. You know, the treatment can be both simple and complex depending on the number of different problems a youngster has, but accommodations are critical. And certainly by giving kids a chance to move around, by giving kids less kind of repetitive homework assignments, by parents understanding to accentuate the positive and try and minimize the amount of negative feedback that these kids get, we try and protect their self-esteem, which is the major purpose of intervening.
Now, talking about self-esteem and so forth, how is it different to parent a child with these kinds of problems?
Well, it is extremely difficult to parent a child because these kids have such poor self-control. And some of the standard techniques that we use and we try and encourage parenting of absolutely normal children need to be just overly emphasized. Number one, these children are very frustrating because it's not unusual for a child with ADHD to have half an hour's worth of homework and 3 hours later it's still not done and there's still the nagging, et cetera, et cetera. So we encourage parents, number one, to learn about it. The best book that I know of is Taking Charge of ADHD by Russell Barkley. It's printed by Guilford Press. And in there, there are very practical, pragmatic guidelines for parenting these kids. But it's very frustrating. You need high structure. We know that transitions are very difficult for these kids. And parents need to understand behavior modification techniques. That in the old days is sending a kid to their room, is removing privileges. It's trying to minimize the yelling, the screaming. And, you know, yelling and screaming at kids or hitting kids just further deflates self-esteem, which is totally self-defeating. So we like to build in structure, consistency, which even for everyday kids, it's very difficult to be totally consistent with kids. But these kids really require a tremendous amount of understanding. For example, a lot of these kids say the first thing that comes to their mind. It can be totally inappropriate. It could be off the wall. Instead of getting angry and being very upset, it's nice if a parent can step back and say, hey, listen, you know, think about what you just said. Why don't you try and rephrase that so that it doesn't quite sound so obnoxious? So it takes a lot of kind of thinking on the part of parents not to react as quickly as the kids do. And ironically, since the disorder sometimes runs in the families, some of the parents will have the disorder and it'll be difficult for them to, you know, control their impulsivity to respond, you know, very harshly or negatively. So we really know that behavior modification, positive reinforcement, setting up programs for the younger kids, it could be daily report cards where, you know, smiley faces, with five smiley faces for each period of the day are sent home if a kid, you know, can work on certain target symptoms like not being out of their seat or talking out in class, et cetera. We like not to remove too many privileges because once kids, you know, have no privileges, you know, there's nothing to use for behavior mod. We certainly don't like to take kids out of activities that are positive for them. Some of these kids find school excruciatingly difficult, whereas maybe playing soccer or painting or the flute or karate or whatever are what builds their self-esteem. So because of academic difficulties or behavioral difficulties, we don't like to remove the things that are other channels for kids to have positive experiences.
Now, that's interesting. You mentioned some activities that would give kids good feelings about themselves, like karate or a musical instrument or something like that. And those are things that require quite a bit of attention to a task.
Right.
Is that, how does that fit
with a kid
that has trouble with that?
You're very correct. I know, for example, practicing the piano can be agony for some of these kids. But I think the key is that each child is an individual. Each one has certain areas and certain things that they really gravitate to. And so the key is to find activities that these kids can stay involved in and be successful. I mean, soccer can be both the best and the worst for these kids. I mean, some of the kids are so socially inappropriate that they annoy their parents. They can't stay with the game. On the other hand, you know, for some of them, just to blow off some energy. And remember, this is not a disorder that the kids just need more exercise. That is not a treatment for ADHD. They're fidgety and restless no matter if they've just, you know, played soccer for 3.5 hours. They're still restless and fidgety. But the point is that it is a real challenge to find activities where they're successful. And I think that's one of the difficulties in parenting these kids. And they also lose interest very quickly. You might sign them up for, you know, lacrosse, and then 2 times later, they're just not interested. So you have to kind of keep being creative. And that's where a good behavioral psychologist can work with parents to reinforce the parents for being consistent, for increasing structure for these kids, strategies for getting homework done so that, you know, you have to do X amount of homework, then you can take a break, then you get a reward, et cetera, and consequences if certain things don't get done.
So it sounds like it's very important when you have a child diagnosed with something like this to get help for yourself as a parent besides getting help for the child.
That's absolutely true. I mean, the amount of relief that parents express to me when I do a consultation, I do evaluate these kids, and I say, look, this is bread and butter, classic ADHD. We have great treatment. Parents, you know, generally for years have been very frustrated getting kids to do things, getting negative feedback from school. And when they find out that this is a neurologically based disorder that is very commonly inherited, although not always inherited, you know, they're very relieved to find that they haven't been doing something wrong, that they haven't created this child who, you know, has no self-control or impulse control or can't focus.
What about discipline with kids like this?
Right. You know, discipline is, in my view, a very important part, and I prefer to make consequences real for these kind of kids. Clearly, for all kids, we want consistency. We want consequences for misbehavior so that they learn. So I think the key is consequences that are short, are brief, are meaningful for individual kids are very important. At the NIH, where we have a day hospital for studying these kids, we use a token economy, so to speak. The kids are paid play money for staying in their seat, for not calling out, et cetera. They can buy things with their play money, no homework, extra time in the playroom, et cetera, et cetera. So I think the key is not to be overly punitive. We certainly don't recommend ever striking children or hitting them. We like timeouts, and that is sending the kids to their room for, you know, 15 minutes or half an hour. My view is that parents should always be the ones to decide when the timeout is over. A timeout should be a period of removal from interactions. And certainly all parents yell and scream and get frustrated. I mean, that's part of being a human being, and some of us had a long day, and it's very difficult. And these kids aren't the best at planning. It'll be 9:30. Dad, can you help with the math? Then the kids get frustrated and the parents get frustrated. I mean, it is very, very difficult to parent these kids. And obviously, you know, in two-parent households, you can share the responsibility. When one parent is getting pushed over the top, the other one can kind of step in and say, hey, listen, let me deal with this. But obviously, if it's a solo parent, it just makes it that much more difficult. And that's where support from friends, parent support groups for ADHD kids can be very useful.
Why does it seem that ADHD problems are so much more prevalent today than in the past? We hear about it so much.
Right.
More.
My understanding is that, in fact, you know, there aren't more ADHD kids. There's more knowledge between the internet, the newspapers, magazines, et cetera. My impression is that it's a very, very popular topic for discussion in our society. You know, it's kind of unusual that the medication, Ritalin, for example, is a quote, controversial medication because of its scheduling by the Drug Enforcement Administration. But it makes for very interesting reading to read about this disorder. It's very unusual. The ironic thing is that of all the behavior problems in child psychiatry, this is the disorder that has the largest amount of research. There are over 5,000 research studies on hyperactive children. There are 300 review articles, each with hundreds of papers. So it's an area that we have probably more information about than any other problem almost in pediatrics. But it seems to generate a lot of interest and controversy. You know, having grown up in Rhode Island in the 50s and 60s, I have had access to the archives of the Bradley Hospital where benzedrine was first used in 1937 for the treatment of hyperactive children. And as early as the 70s, there were headlines, you know, miracle or nightmare, you know, stimulants, et cetera. But for some reason, it generates a lot of publicity and people are very interested. With education and the training of teachers, people are much more aware that a kid who, you know, is out of his seat, is talking out of class, is, you know, much people in more educated circles are much more aware that kids' behavior is determined by genes, it's determined by environment, it's determined by a lot of things. And we certainly know that, you know, reading disability is a neurological problem, but people are much, much more aware of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder now. And I think that's why kids are being diagnosed. But if you look in, for example, rural areas, research shows that most kids are not being identified. You look at an epidemiologically based study, that is a study where you look at every child in three counties. In fact, the incidence, which is about 4% of all children, have the disorder, but very few of those children are being identified or treated because of lack of providers. So if you ask me, is ADHD being overdiagnosed in the United States? Yes, in some very affluent suburbs of some cities and communities, it is. But for the vast majority of kids in the United States today, most of the kids who have it, which again would be about 4% of all school-age children, most of those kids are not being identified or treated in this country.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion of attention deficit disorder and attention deficit hyperactivity disorder.
For an audio cassette copy of any parent's perspective show, send a check or money order for $5 with your name, address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C., 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. Today we are talking with Dr. Alan Zemetkin about ADD and ADHD. It doesn't sound like you go along with the arguments some make about environmental factors influencing this.
Well, you know, clearly one can argue that, the diagnosis and the disorder is a product of sort of the 20th and 21st century. I mean, we do require kids to go to school until they're 16 years old. And school is, you know, is a very, you know, when you think about it, it's a round peg in a square hole kind of problem. Now, fortunately, our public schools have to educate a humongous, tremendous array of children from very low IQ, multiply handicapped, learning disabled kids to gifted and talented kids who kids could go off to college and, you know, in the 10th grade. So you have a public school system who has this mandate to educate all these kids. In the 20s and 30s where kids would be on the farm or could, you know, would be dropping out of school or the, you know, the big schoolhouse where, you know, there might be multiple grades, you know, the ability to sit and get work done was not there. And we have much higher standards now for our educational setting. So I do think that if that's the argument about environment, yes, our argument is our environment now is demanding much higher levels of learning on the part of kids, and learning takes attention and concentration. Ironically, you know, if you look at the report cards of almost any school system I've ever seen, not only do kids get grades, but they get ratings on their behavior. I mean, there's, you know, there's staying in their seat, there's self-control, there's cooperation. And it's ironic that of all the ratings of kids' behavior that you see on a standard report card, many, many of them are symptoms of ADHD because educators know that this is such a common problem.
You don't think that in the 20th and 21st centuries where we have more toxins around, that that's an issue? I know that's come up.
Right. I think parents are always looking for either dietary explanations, environmental explanations, asbestos, you know, lead, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, there have been a handful of studies where people have tried to document that, and no one has been able to document it in my mind. It would be nice if we could, you know, identify a certain food additive or whatever, but, you know, 20 research studies later, no one has been able to support what was known as the Feingold hypothesis, which was that salicylates and food additives. That's 20 separate research studies trying to find it. Now, if parents come to me and say, listen, I think because my kid's eating too much sugar or this, or, you know, their diet is terrible, they have these problems, I don't argue with parents who firmly believe that. I encourage them to try and change their kid's diet or do any other alternative. I don't discourage that. But on the other hand, you know, sometimes kids are tried on those, you know, changing their environment, changing their diet, et cetera, and it doesn't help. So that's the time to step in with other interventions.
One of the things that you had mentioned is sometimes ADHD runs in families. Do you think it's helpful for children to be told that, you know, Uncle Jimmy used to have this as well, that kind of thing?
Right. You know, of all the findings in the world of clinical research on ADHD, the inheritance of ADHD is a very firmly established phenomenon. There are at least 15 research studies showing that ADHD runs in families. And there are studies all over the world now trying to find genetic markers. Of all the disorders in psychiatry, ADHD has one of the greatest chances of having a biological marker found. So I'm very optimistic. Now, to directly answer your question, does it help for a child to know that it runs in family? The answer is yes. Most of the time, the parents of ADHD kids have become successful. They generally have found occupations that they can adapt their symptoms to. And I do think that it is helpful for kids to know that other people have it, that other people have been successful, and that it is a treatable problem.
Dr. Zemetkin, what resources would you suggest for parents who are listening now who might want to know a little bit more about ADHD and ADD?
One of the best resources available to parents is a national parent support group that is located in Landover, Maryland. This support group has chapters throughout the United States, and parents themselves who have struggled with this problem are a great source of resources for other parents who may be wondering about ADHD. The reason that this is so is that there are individual providers, whether social workers, psychologists, pediatricians, who are better, and there are others who are worse at identifying and treating this problem. And networks of parents who have been, you know, through the system, understand how to interact with schools, how to advocate for the kids, are amongst the best sources. The national group is called CHADD, which is C-H-A-D-D. They're located in Landover, Maryland, and their 800 number is 800-233-4050. That's 800-233-4050. And on the web, it's www.chadd, C-H-A-D-D, ADD.org. And they can be called or contacted, and they have chapters all over the United States, a tremendous organization. They also are affiliated with an outlet for materials on ADHD, from workbooks, star charts, et cetera. And that is called the ADD Warehouse, which is located in Plantation, Florida. And they have a wonderful catalog that has all kinds of interesting reading materials. Their phone number is 800-233-9273. So those are two places to start. And networking with other parents who have kids who have been either evaluated, followed in the schools, I think is the best way to get started.
You could call and ask for their catalog free, I'm sure.
That's right. Okay.
Well, you have certainly given us and all the listening parents a wonderful way of getting started. So thank you very much, Dr. Alan Zametkin, for all your insights and your encouragement.
It's a pleasure being here. Thank you.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of our book, Washington, D.C. with Kids. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. And tell us what station you're listening to. Since we're airing all over the world, it's always fun to know what station you're tuning in from. Parents as Mentors and Washington, D.C. with Kids are both available at all major bookstores and on the web.
To learn more about us and our books, Parents as Mentors and Washington, D.C. with Kids, visit our website, http://i.am/parentsperspective. That's http://i.am/parentsperspective. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents' Perspective. Our sound engineer is Damon Fisher. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.